Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Topic today is capital gains tax. And, of course, the other tax proposals associated that Biden's been raising here, the latest being this past week, a proposal to raise the capital gains tax on wealthy investors and corporations from its current 20% rate to 39.6% rate. In other words, almost doubling of the capital gains tax, which, by the way, was almost cut in half by Trump in 2018. At that time, I believe it was either 28% or 35%, reduced to 20%. Okay, so the proposal here is to tax capital gains like regular earned income. In other words, just the way workers' wages are taxed, they're going to tax capital gains. Same thing. The increase, of course, is only affecting income in a year that's earned over $1 million. Only $1 million from capital gains. And so, in other words, if you've invested in some stock here or there, and you know you got a couple $1,000 gain on the sale of the stock or the bond, that's not part of this proposal. You got to make $1 million gain in order to have this raise, and it's going to affect less than 1% of total households in the U.S. And it really reflects a number of proposals like Biden has proposed to raise the corporate tax rate from 21% to 28%. And by the way, Trump had cut that from 35 to 21. So raise it partially back was the idea here. And the corporate tax rate, the marginal corporate tax rate, and some other proposals as well, which are already identified, like raising the estate tax by reducing the exemption back down to 2009 levels. And again, Trump and Republicans had pretty much exempted estate tax, inheritance tax, on the first $11.5 million of estate value, $23 million if you're a couple, which cut huge amounts from the estate tax. So, in other words, what Biden is trying to do is to reverse some of the trends, massive tax cut trends that occurred under Trump, but only partially. You know, take back some of the huge tax windfall that was given to investors and corporations and the very wealthy in 2018. Now, in 2018, the justification that Trump made was that, oh, this is going to stimulate real investment. In other words, investment in business, investment in plant and equipment and inventories and structures and buildings and so forth, and that would boost the economy. Well, business investment in 2019 declined every month for 9 months. And then, of course, it fell through the floor in 2020, so we can't use that as a comparison. That's a COVID thing. But in the last year, or the full year after Trump's tax cut, it actually declined. So it's a fiction to argue, as business media does, and Republicans do, and the wealthy do, that, oh, you know, if you tax me for more, I'm going to have less income, and therefore I'm going to invest less and create fewer jobs, and therefore wages and income and GDP. That's the argument. Well, that argument has been around for a long, long time. You know, you go back to the 1930s, and that was the argument of economists at the time of the Great Depression, that, oh, you know, What we've got to do is give business more disposable income. We've got to cut taxes. Oh, we got to lower interest rate costs. And oh, we even have to lower wages. And that will give business more disposable income. And the assumption, erroneous, was that if they have more disposable income, they will automatically use it to invest and expand. And that will generate more jobs and more income and so forth. In other words, the depression caused by the collapse of business investment, the way to solve the Great Depression was to give business more money. That was the solution. That was the cause of the depression, but the solution was reward the people that caused the depression by increasing their disposable income. Well, the economist Keynes came along in 1935 and said, well, that's all ass backwards, you know, because if you lower wages, you're lowering household income, wage income, and therefore consumption. And if people don't have enough money to buy goods, business isn't going to invest and expand if no one's buying what they already are producing. Therefore, cutting costs for businesses, whether it's tax costs or borrowing costs or wages, you know, is nonsense. You're going to get the exact opposite result by giving more income to business, because business will hoard it, you see. They'll sit on it. Or they'll send it somewhere else in the world where things are better and people are buying stuff. Or, you know, they'll park it in financial asset markets. Well, that's reality of what does occur when you got a contracted economy and you try to cut business costs, whether it's tax cuts, you know, or zero interest rates, the Fed, or wage cuts. Doesn't happen. The opposite happens. Well, that debate was, you know, pretty much resolved in 1935. Keynes talked about it. And the New Deal put that talk in action, and we got some recovery. So just the opposite. See, in economics, there's reality, facts, economic science, and there's ideology, misrepresentations, lies, manipulating economic ideas and concepts and data to produce a policy that benefits the rich and the corporations. That's economic ideology. And economics is full of it. It's full of these misrepresentations. I'm talking about academic economics, right? Full of it. And this is one proposal, you know, that, oh, raising tax capital gains is going to stifle investment and therefore slow the economy. That's economic ideology. That's not science, because just the opposite is the truth. Keynes pointed it out in 1935, and it's still an issue today, because what's happening now in the wake of Biden saying he's going to raise capital gains is this apoplectic business media. I mean, it's all over the media, you know, and Bloomberg TV, in the Wall Street Journal, everywhere. Oh, you can't raise capital gains because, you know, we stifle investment. Well, the capital gains cut didn't encourage investment, so raising it isn't going to stifle it, because we never got anything out of the tax cut anyway. And, you know, Biden and some economists see this. They see the capital gains tax cut didn't do anything for the real economy. It made the rich richer. You know, reducing capital gains taxation to 20%, and by the way, that's before loopholes, you see, which reduces it even more if you got corporate tax lawyers. Reducing it to 20% ended up in declining real investment, because there's lots of factors that determine the outcome of investment, not just taxation. But that's the argument. That's the ideological argument. Oh, you know, and economics is full of this crap. Economic sciences, you know, oh, like free trade will benefit everybody, you know, or oh, workers aren't getting more income because they're not productive enough. Go get an education, workers. It's your fault that productivity is slowing in the economy, or tax cuts create jobs. You know, I mean, economics is full of this ideology, because economic ideas are created sometimes by people who are on the indirect payroll of the rich. Yeah. So sometimes it's hard for laymen to sift through what's ideology and misrepresentation and lies and what is really science and economics. But I'll tell you, raising capital gains will stifle investment is ideology. It's not science, because the facts don't support it, you see. That's the litmus test, the facts. What do the facts say, right? Oh, well, they're all saying now, it's going to hurt the capital markets if you raise the capital gains tax from 20% to 39.6% and tax it as wage income. But even then, you know, only over $1 million you tax as wage income and capital gains, not the first million. Wouldn't it be nice if we didn't have to pay the regular tax rate as workers and consumers on our first $1 million of income? That would be nice. It would eliminate our income tax, I'm sure. Oh, but, you know, businesses and investors get exempt the first $1 million of capital gains. It hurts the capital markets. Well, what the hell are capital markets? Capital markets. Money, money. Think of money capital. Capital markets. Oh, this is the stock market. That's a capital market. The bond markets, corporate bonds, right? Foreign exchange currency, derivatives. These are all money capital markets. Right? Oh, they're worried that it's going to hurt the capital markets. And by the way, the debate ignores all the tax loopholes that underlie raising this tax rate. But let's look at a little bit of the history here, right? After 2008 and 2009, Obama cut taxes on corporations and on dividends to the tune of $288 billion in 2009, and 2010 continued the Bush tax cuts, $800 billion more. And then in 2012, agreed to extend the Bush tax cuts of the early part of the decade in perpetuity, which will cost another $5 trillion. So over $6 trillion, Obama cut taxes on corporations and the rich simply by continuing the Bush tax cuts. Yeah, he didn't raise the income that the government would then use to redirect government spending to stimulate the economy. At the same time, because the taxes were nicely cut for investors, capital gains and corporate rate and whatever, individual, nicely cut, corporations gave their shareholders $6 trillion in dividend payouts and stock buybacks. Ah, capital gains, dividends, stock buybacks. That's capital gains. They got $6 trillion in distribution under Obama. Well, that's just about what he cut their taxes by extending the Bush tax cuts, $6 trillion. Think about that. $6 trillion in tax cuts, $6 trillion in dividends and stock buybacks. Over the Obama administration, 8 years. Well, is that a shift in income? Yeah. That's why the wealthiest 1%, according to Berkeley economists, got 95% of all the gains in the economy during the Obama recovery. Of all the income generated by the growth of the economy, according to Professor Emmanuel Saez and his ELSA database, 95% of it went to the wealthiest 1%. 95%. Under Bush, it was 68%. Under Clinton, it was 45%. So they get more and more and more of all the wealth being created by the real economy. Almost all of it went to the wealthy under Obama. Almost all, 95%. Don't believe me. Just go check Professor Emmanuel Saez, S-A-E-Z, ELSA database, UC Berkeley economist, famous now. You know, been doing this for almost 20 years, looking at the wealth of the 1% and the tax system. So keep that in mind, you know, under Obama, $6 trillion tax cuts, $6 trillion dividends, stock buybacks, i.e. capital gains. Oh, what about Trump? Well, Trump comes in, he passes his 2018 massive, more than $4 trillion in tax cuts over a decade, half of which go to multinational corporations. They don't talk about that. What happened to stock buybacks and dividends? Averaging for the first 3 years of Trump, 17, 18, 19, $1.3 trillion a year. Under Obama, it was around $800 to $900 billion a year. So in other words, Trump's tax cuts increased capital gains revenue for the rich, you know, those who speculate in stocks, you know, in bonds and other securities, by about $400 billion a year, 3 years in a row, averages $1.3 trillion. Instead of averaging $900 billion on Obama, is $1.3 trillion under Trump. Well, that's a nice piece of change, isn't it? We can't count 2020 because it gets, you know, impacted, distorted by COVID and so forth. Almost $4 trillion in dividend and stock buybacks under Trump. $4 trillion tax cut under Trump. I mean, you know, these are correlations, but it's a smoking gun, folks. It was a smoking gun under Obama. It's a smoking gun under Trump. Think about it. Since 2009, Great Recession, investors, corporations, and investors got $10 trillion in stock buybacks and dividend payouts. $10 trillion that didn't go to the U.S. Treasury. And therefore, $10 trillion hit on U.S. deficits and the national debt. Half of the national debt was due to these tax cuts, capital gains especially, that benefited the 1% since 2009. Half, roughly half. That's a fact. Go check it out. Look at the national income accounts if you want. Go check it out. And we're going to raise some, reverse some of that under Biden, only some. And of course, that's his opening statement. He'll backtrack even more. Look, you know, the corporate tax rate under Trump was 35%. He reduced that corporate top marginal tax rate to 21%. Biden has proposed to raise it to 28 only, halfway. And he's given public signals saying, oh, well, you know, that's negotiable. And by the way, it's the 28% over 15 years. Right? And that's negotiable. Well, his capital gains proposal will be negotiable, too, you can bet. There'll be some of the clawback, as they say, of the great windfall under Trump in capital gains at 20%, supposedly going to 39.6%. I predict that it won't go above 30%. Just as I predict that the corporate marginal top rate supposedly going to 28 won't go any higher than 25. Okay, so it's some increase, right? But it's not a big increase, and it's over 10, 15 years, you know? So what are the crybabies crying about there in the business media, in Wall Street Journal, in Bloomberg TV? And, you know, what are they crying about? Oh, we're going to take back a pittance from you over 15 years in order to fund, to finance real investment in the infrastructure bill that you guys won't do. You guys, the private sector, won't do. The government has to do it. Got to get the money somewhere. We're going to take back a little bit from you. They're wailing and gnashing their teeth and wringing their hands. Oh, you know, we're not going to get $1 trillion a year. And by the way, you know, I forgot to mention, you know, when we talk about $800-900 billion in buybacks and dividends under Obama and $1.3 trillion a year under Trump, that's just the Fortune 500 companies. Yeah. Investors in the Fortune 500 companies. You know, there's thousands, tens of thousands of other companies that are large and give corporations that give buybacks and pay out dividends. These folks have been raking in the dough here for decades now at ever-growing levels. And the fortunes amassed are mind-boggling. We're talking tens of trillions that they've been able to redistribute to themselves by controlling government and policies. I go into this a lot more detail in my 2020 book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, which looks at these policies and particularly looks at the evolution of the tax policy since Reagan and documents this whole trend through Trump, through 2019 Trump. Okay, so we're having a little bit of a shift here under Biden because they got to fund these investments, these real investments, if the U.S. economy is not going to relapse and collapse again. They've got to do this. They know this. And they know, the Democrats, Biden, know they got a limited time to do it in. They got to do it now, this year, because 2022 may reverse the whole situation again in the midterm elections. In 2024, they got a small window to do it, to make real investment and real job creation somehow happen so that people see a real difference and that they can stay in power in 2022, because their margins in the House of Representatives is like 6. And in the Senate, there is none. There's 1. And then you got these Democrat senators like Joe Manchin and Sinema in Arizona, who are really Republicans in disguise. So, you know, they've got to bribe them somehow, big time, in order to get them to vote on things, these proposals. And, you know, Joe Manchin and others are meeting with corporate, you know, campaign contributors all the time. What should we do, boys? What should we do? So they're really representing corporate interest here. Now, once again, roughly the tax cuts under Trump equal the buybacks and dividend payouts under Trump, and the same under Obama. Well, what's happened since 2020 here? What happened last year? Continue the historical parallels. Well, did corporations get tax cuts? More tax cuts? You bet. The CARES Act last March gave them $650 billion in more tax cuts. Did they do anything with it? Did they expand? No, they sat on it. They hoarded it, or they refunneled it into stock markets and bond markets. You know, it's the old debate back in 1935, Keynes versus, you know, conservative economists representing business interests, who said, oh, you got to give businesses more disposable income if you want them to invest. Well, we gave them more, even more, last year, $650 billion. Did it stimulate investment? No. Because with so many people laid off, no one was able to buy much. Certainly not able to buy services. So if business sees that, no one's buying stuff, what are they going to do? They're going to expand and make more stuff to buy when they can't sell the stuff they're already trying to sell? I mean, it's simple logic. No, they're not going to. But they'll take the tax cuts. They'll sit on it. They'll hoard it. Yeah, they won't turn it away. They won't spend it. And then what happened on top of the $650 billion in the CARES Act? Well, the government gave another $525 billion to small businesses. Gave, yeah. They were called loans, but they turned into grants. So it's kind of like a tax refund, you see, for small businesses. That was in April, $525 billion. And then in December, another $190 billion to small businesses. And now Biden's proposing even more tax cuts for small businesses in the form of credits. You know, American Rescue Plan, I think there's like $40 billion more for small businesses. And now he's proposing even more under the infrastructure bill and new small business credits. So the government is giving tax cut in different forms to small businesses, which, by the way, need it most. We got a shift in taxation going on. Not a cut, a shift in business taxation. We're raising taxes on wealthy investors and big corporations, and we're cutting taxes in the form of grants and credits for small businesses. Oh, but you don't hear Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg saying that, do you? That's really a shift in business taxation. And to some extent, I mean, it's not equal here. You know, the tax hikes on big businesses and on the smaller credits for smaller businesses, you know, it's not equal. You know, small businesses aren't getting, you know, all the tax hike revenue that's being proposed. Now, some of it is necessary for the government infrastructure program. So really what it is not just a shift to small business tax cuts, it's also a shift for the government to redirect real investment that business won't do. You know, you got to distinguish between financial asset investment, stocks and bonds and so forth, and real asset investment that economists call it. Well, what's that? Well, that's in real plant and equipment, inventories, structures, business structures, factories, residential construction, apartments, and so forth. That's what we call real investment. It's a major category in the GDP, real investment, broken down by those sectors, plant and equipment, inventories, software and intellectual property, structures, business structures like malls, hotels, lodging, office buildings, factories. Those are business structures. Residential construction, new homes, and multi-apartment structures, residential structures. That's real investment. Now, that means, real investment means you got to hire people to make the stuff. When you hire people, they get income, right, from their jobs, households, and they spend it, and that becomes consumption, which is 2/3 at least of the economy, GDP. Do they create any jobs when they invest in stocks and bonds? No. None at all. No job creation, no real income creation by investing in financial assets. By the way, not just financial assets here in the U.S., they invest in financial assets everywhere around the world. Move their money around from this stock bond market to that stock bond market, wherever, right? And they can do it because of technology and the globalization of finance, which is a big problem. Global financialization and capitalism in the 21st century means capitalist investors now have this great incentive to push their money into financial asset markets around the world and move it instantaneously because of technology from one to the other market. That's a big problem. It's sucking the lifeblood out of capitalism, you see. It's sucking all the money capital out of real investment, you know, out of structures and inventories and equipment and stuff, real things that hire real people that generate real income and spending. That's the big problem with capitalism, you see, and that trend continues towards financialization, money capital, growth, income being redirected, distorted into financial asset markets. I wrote about this in great detail in my 2017 book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, describing and predicting this financialization that's going on. Financialization meaning, you know, creation of all these highly liquid financial markets everywhere that are all linked, and the money capital moves around electronically, instantaneously. And you have these institutions now that are focused on capitalist financial institutions, you know, hedge funds, equity funds, peer-to-peer lending, etc., on moving the money around here. And you've got not just the institutions that have been grown up around this proliferation of financial markets globally, you got what we call agents, capitalists, finance capital, new finance capital elite that just do that, you know, using these new institutions, move their money around globally here and there. It's a global money parade, you see, and we can see it happening here in the U.S., you know, and globally. There's maybe a 250,000 of these new global finance capital elite. And they're at the top of the apex of the capitalist profit machine. And they're making so much money, you know, more and more capitalists say, well, I want to be like them. The point is, we've been giving tax cut, tax cut, tax cut to corporations and investors, you know, at the core of which is this capital gains tax. And they haven't been investing it in real things that create real goods for real people. Okay, and that means that the real investment has been atrophying. Real investment, you know, in those categories that create jobs has been slowly shrinking over time. And that's why productivity is shrinking. And that's why incomes, high-paid jobs are not available. And wage incomes tend to stagnate for that and other reasons. You know, that's what's going on. So the Biden proposal sees this, and Biden says, hey, this is, you know, we can't keep going down this road. We're going to have to do something to turn it around. Well, the state, the capitalist state, steps in and says, well, you know, we got to re-stimulate here real investment once again to create jobs. Or, you know, look, it took 7 years after the Great Recession of 2008-09 for jobs to return to levels in 2007. 7 years. And the jobs that returned, the number of jobs, paid significantly less than the jobs that were lost. Oh, that means net wage income decline. And that's why things were so stagnant during the Obama years. Well, Biden says we can't do that again or we're going to get wiped out in 2022. So he says, you know, we got to go big. Go big, go better, right? That's the theme. Go big. You got to make up this massive hole in typical household income created by COVID, which was already, even before COVID, shrinking. You got to fill that hole somehow. Well, that was the American Rescue Plan, right? The first $1.9 trillion, actually $1.8 proposal. In other words, try to fill that black hole of lost income for typical working families, especially those in the services sectors, where it had the lowest wage, the lowest pay. fill the hole. That's temporary, you know. Filling the hole, you know, is not the solution. It's just the beginning of the solution. And that's why Biden's proposed the infrastructure spending. In other words, that's what's designed to regenerate and grow sustainably the economy, if it gets passed in time. That's what real growth would be. You know, the first leg of this, the American Rescue Plan, the COVID relief bill, whatever you want to call it, was just mitigation. In other words, put a hole under what's happened, a floor under, and fill the hole. Now we got to really do the stimulus. That's the infrastructure plan. And the announcement coming on the 28th of this month, which is the family relief plan or something like family plan. That's designed to provide sustainable income support for families. The COVID relief just filled the black hole. Now you got to do something because we've got a lot of people who are structurally stuck in low wages, low pay. We got to do something for them, right? Child care. You know, if you could pass this government provided child care like other advanced countries have done, well, that would be a big boost to total income for families, including middle-class families, that are paying huge amounts now for child care. In order for both to work, you know, they're paying hundreds of dollars a week, sometimes more, $500 or more a week for child care. I'm talking about, you know, preschoolers. Part of the family leave plan that's coming will be also to provide government-paid preschool, pre-kindergarten. Well, that's to relieve some of the child care costs, you see. But also to make, well, not permanent, but until 2025, the child tax credit that was passed under the COVID relief bill here. You know, one of the more positive elements of the COVID relief bill was for families to get child care support monthly. In other words, you won't have to wait till you file your taxes, but it's refundable is the term, which means they'll start payments in July. But that's only good for 1 year, you see. The family leave plan will propose that it's good until 2025. And other support for elderly care so they can stay in their homes. And a number of other proposals here that are designed to more permanently boost a household income. Because people aren't getting wage increases, you see. So someone's got to supplement their income because it's not enough to survive on. Well, that's what the family leave plan. But the infrastructure plan is designed for long-term job stimulus in a whole number of areas. You know, I went over this, I think, a week or so ago, the infrastructure plan. And before that, I went over the COVID relief, $1.8 trillion. Infrastructure is about $2 trillion. So if you want to, you know, listen to my early analysis of those, just check out on the podcast here for the show. I think 2 weeks ago I covered the infrastructure proposal, the initial elements of it, and a couple of weeks before that, the COVID relief, $1.8 trillion. But you got to see this thing in a context, you know. You got to see $1.8 trillion, okay, fill the hole, mitigation. Okay, $2.2 trillion, let's get jobs created here by doing what business isn't doing. In other words, stimulating the infrastructure, building the infrastructure. Now, and then the family leave would be, okay, it's going to take a while to get these infrastructure building. So going forward, we need these other family leave measures to sustain the households, because the COVID relief only filled the hole. You know, now we got to make sure that the hole doesn't grow again. So the family leave program is designed to provide more income to households so that they can fill the gap before the infrastructure, which takes time to really kick in terms of job creation, really is able to kick in. So the three go together, you see. There are three legs of the stool here. Rescue plan, COVID relief plan, in other words, infrastructure plan called the American Jobs Act and the family plan that's coming here on the 28th. Three of them are together, and they are focusing on different time periods, you see. COVID relief looks at the past, fill the hole. Infrastructure looks at the more distant future. Family leave buys us time in the interim. You know, you put them all together and it's like a $4 trillion fiscal stimulus over the next couple of years. $4 trillion. Of course, it's stretched out a lot longer than that. But, you know, that's what I was saying a year ago, March 2020, would be necessary to really jumpstart the economy and sustain growth in the midst of this COVID impact. That's what I said, $4 trillion. Well, now we're getting $4 trillion, but a year late, you see. We didn't get it earlier because McConnell and Trump prevented it from April of last year through the election here earlier this year. They prevented it. They stepped on it. They didn't want to spend it. We would be in such a disaster right now if they were still in office. Mitch McConnell was still calling the shots. We would be in such a disaster. We would be well on our way to a Great Depression because they just would not spend it on infrastructure and on households and on jobs and so forth. As long as their buddies, their campaign contributors, the big corporations and the rich were taken care of, and they were, in the first 3 months of last year, they were taken care of. They didn't need anything. That's all they cared about. But we only got a window here, short window of opportunity. You know, you got about 18 months. The Democrats got to make this economy get going and got to make a difference to the real incomes of folks. Because the COVID Act is not enough. That just brings us to a jump-off point, and that jump-off point needs some short-term further stimulus in the Family Act and a long-term sustainable stimulus in the infrastructure bill. And you got to pay for it somehow. Well, how are you paying for it? Well, that's where the Biden tax hikes come in. You know, and this week we're talking about capital gains being raised from the 20% cut to by Trump to back to 39.6. And I was tax it like wage income and raised the corporate tax rate from 21 to 28% halfway back. That's the top marginal rate on corporate incomes over $1 million, you know, and the same for the capital gains over $1 million. So, you know, capitalists below that are nothing's going to change for them. And raise the personal income tax top rate for those over 400,000 income each year from 37.6. And restore back the exemptions and the inheritance tax. You see, those are the four major taxes that exist. Corporate taxes, as far as government revenue is concerned. Corporate taxes, individual income taxes, inheritance or estate taxes, capital gains taxes, and then, of course, there's the payroll tax on top of that. That's the federal tax structure is composed of that, those elements. Over 90-some percent of all federal revenue come from that. But the government's having to step in here and do the investment, redirect and make sure we get real investment. That's what this is about. That's what these tax changes are about. The government needs revenue in order to do that, because business won't do it. Just like Keynes said in 1935, they'll sit on it. You cut their costs, whether it's tax costs or wages or whatever, they'll hoard it. They'll sit on it. You won't get a recovery. You'll stagnate down at a low level. Well, Mitch McConnell was willing to stagnate that low level. He didn't care. His buddies got taken care of. But you should see the tax proposals from Biden as one, a shift from big business to small business at one level. In other words, raising taxes on big investors, big business, and we're giving more credits and so forth to small business. You should see it as a way to shift real investment in the economy into the planning and the hands of government, because business won't do it, right? And also, it's a way of the U.S. Participating and jump-starting the economy to some extent by investing in climate, alternative energy. That's in there, too. That's a big part of the infrastructure. In other words, change the infrastructure in the U.S. more towards alternative energy. And thereby, participate in trying to do something. Big countries around the world have announced just this past week as well an effort to do something about climate change in terms of spending. Well, we'll see how far that goes. At the same time, they're talking about the U.S. and Europe, at least, maybe Japan, talking about doing something about the way multinational corporations are gaming different countries' tax systems. Moving their costs around on paper so they pay less taxes here or there, moving their headquarters here or there. It's called inversions, loopholes. There's all these kind of loopholes. There's a race to the bottom in global corporate taxation. Corporations playing one country against the other, just as they successfully did in the U.S. playing one state against the other. We had a race to the bottom in corporate taxes within the states in the U.S. Corporate tax rates are like 2%, 2.5%. And whenever a company doesn't like paying that, it tells its politicians of that state, well, we're going to go to another state if you don't give us more tax cuts. And it's a race to the bottom. Well, the corporation's been playing that globally as well. The global tax rate for corporations under Trump, when Trump came in office, was 35%. 35% on offshore profits. Of course, they weren't paying any of that. They were just letting it sit overseas and not paying it and not having any consequences for letting it sit in their overseas subsidiaries. By the way, that goes back to Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton introduced on these corporate IRS forms what was called check the box. And that was, you check the box that you were making profits overseas and then you were suspending payment of taxes. That was okay. So Democrats are, in this game as well as Republicans. At least so were Obama and Clinton. We'll see where Biden falls. Because out of desperation, they can't do a Clinton-Obama thing, or they're going to be swept out of office. But it was 35% on corporations, nominally at least. And Trump lowered that to 10.5%. And he exempted for 1 year any of the profits that they would bring home themselves voluntarily. So you bring home what you got and reinvest it in the U.S. And of course, you get invested by buying other companies, mergers and acquisitions, and buying stock, which means it didn't help much to the economy. But you could bring it home for free the first year, 2018, and then you pay 10.5% before your tax lawyers started manipulating the loopholes. So you ended up paying 7-8%. Instead of 35%. And probably less than that, right? Because under Trump, if you're a foreign U.S. corporation offshore, you could deduct the taxes you pay to other countries from the taxes you would owe to Uncle Sam. Yeah. So that reduced it even bigger. And you could do that on a global basis. You could manipulate all the other taxes you paid everywhere else and deduct that. So the 10.5% got whacked real, you know, probably less than 5%. Well, under Obama, the proposal is to raise that 10.5% back up to 20-something. I forget exactly what. Yeah. Not 35. That was halfway again. 20-something on foreign profits. And eliminate the proposal to under Trump, in which you deducted foreign government taxes from your U.S. taxes, and to prevent this aggregating globally, it had to be done country by country now. So taking back the huge tax cuts given by Trump to multinational corporations, which totaled over $2 trillion, taking some of that back, taking back some of the corporate top tax rate, you know, from 21 to 28%, taking back some of the inheritance tax, and now the capital gains, raising it back up to 39%. But as I said, you know, that's just the start point. They're going to negotiate further, and I predict that the capital gains tax will probably come in around 28%, raising it from 20 to 28%, maybe 30, more like 28, over a million. Or although, you know, maybe they'll expand that. Maybe capital gains over 2 million or 1.5 million before Joe Manchin gets through with it, right? It won't be a 39% capital gains on income over 1 million. It will be something more generous. But more than they were paying under Trump, because the government's got to raise some revenue somehow to pay for these infrastructure bills and these family relief income and the COVID relief bill. Now, some of it doesn't have to be paid for with tax revenue. The government will probably get the Federal Reserve and the Treasury to issue more U.S. bonds and raise money through borrowing, through debt, as they say, government debt. That'll be part of it as well. Probably as much raised through corporate debt, corporate borrowing, government debt, treasuries, in other words, treasuries, notes, bills, well, notes and bonds. Bills are short term. Notes are medium term, 5 years, 10 years. Treasury bonds are 30 years. So they'll raise money that way as well, but they'll raise taxes too. And it won't affect the economy because it's not going into the real economy anyway under Trump. It's going into financial markets and going offshore abroad, being sucked out of the U.S. economy, being sucked out of the real economy into the financial markets. So, you know, when the corporate media and business media say, oh, this is going to hurt the capital markets, well, yeah, it'll hurt stock and bond markets. So what? But it will benefit the rest of real America if we actually get infrastructure. And infrastructure needs to be broadly conceived today, as Biden accurately is saying. Infrastructure is not just roads and bridges and ports. Yeah, it's that. But infrastructure is, you know, providing incentives for new technology and development and alternative energy and new jobs and so forth. That's all infrastructure, too. And human beings are part of the infrastructure. You know, if you've got an educated workforce, that's as important as having good roads, at least, more so. So, you know, it's all part of a big picture and a big fight over capitalism, to sum up here. This is capitalism, American capitalism, that under neoliberalism since Reagan has drifted off track and got derailed in 2008-09 and hasn't been able to get really back on track. And Obama couldn't put it back on track. He let it run, you know, roughly off track. And then Trump didn't give a damn and said, hell, we're just going to continue redistributing the income. So it's in big trouble long term. U.S. capitalism is in big trouble long term. And the smarter of the capitalists realize this. And they say, we got to get this thing back on track. We got to restore an economy that at least gives some sharing of it to the 99%, actually the 90, 80%, truly 80%. Because they're being left in the lurch here. They're getting nothing. You know, 95%, remember, 95% under Obama went to the 1%, you know. And things are crumbling, not just the infrastructure crumbling, but the social structure is crumbling. People are losing faith in the government. And people are losing faith in this system, which is bigger than the government. 65% want a union to protect them. The youth, I don't know, well over 50% say, hey, socialism might be a good idea. Whatever that means to them. It means not the above that they got now, you see. They don't know what it means, but they know it. What it doesn't mean. You know, the smarter ones in the U.S. capitalists know this. They know this. And then you see the radical right rising on all the discontent and everything. And that's another problem being generated by the inequalities and lack of sharing of social benefits that more and more of the population is having to deal with. They know this. So think of the Biden initiatives as an attempt to try to turn around and make it a more palatable neoliberalism. You know, not such a lopsided neoliberalism. Whether they can do this remains to be seen, but it's their last chance, you see. What happens between now and 2022 and 2024 is the last chance to restore the old neoliberal order on a fairer basis, because it was moving to less and less fair over the decades. Can they restore it? Well, we'll see. This is the great juncture we're in. This is the great experiment we're in. And we shall see over the next 12, 18 months whether it succeeds or not. Exciting times. Historically, economically. But we'll keep tracking this and commenting on it, and I'll be writing on it more on my blog, jackrasmus.com, if you want to catch up on my printed stuff, or just keep checking the podcast here on Alternative Visions and PRN, where I'm talking about it, you know, verbally. Okay, that's it for today. I'm out of here.